May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jason Middleton, registration number 25314, and I'm appearing on behalf of Sean Luke in this case. First of all, I'd like to thank the court and counsel for rescheduling this argument due to my previous illness. I appreciate that. On behalf of Mr. Luke, I believe there are several issues in this case that warrant reversal. The issue I plan to focus on for purposes of the argument is related to the expert testimony of the two experts, Candy Moore and Dr. Deborah Crawford. Just a brief background, as the court may recall, Mr. Luke and the mother of the children were married. She had one child from a previous relationship, and they had two biological children together. The allegations in this case stem from March of 2002 to June of 2003. Mr. Luke left the house in May of 2004 and had no additional contact with the children. In June of 2005, the mother and a new boyfriend came forth with these allegations for the first time. The children were interviewed and no charges were pursued. In 2009, Mr. Luke was living in Washington State and received some reports of a dependency and neglect action involving the mother and his children, and contacted the social services or the social worker in Colorado to inquire about additional contact with his children or custody of the children. At that point, the social worker contacted the mother of the children, and based upon that contact, there were additional allegations that were brought forth against Mr. Luke in the fall of 2009. At trial, it was essentially a credibility contest. Mr. Luke testified that he did not have any sexual contact with the children. There was evidence that there had been a pretext phone call during which he had denied any sexual contact with the children, and he denied it when he was interrogated by the investigating officer in Washington State. The children, on the other hand, accused him of sexual acts. The youngest child had passed away prior to trial due to unrelated incidents, but his brother testified regarding something that he allegedly witnessed. Candy Moore was admitted as an expert in child sexual abuse on a variety of grounds. During her direct testimony, one of the questions was whether or not sexual offenders may allege that someone had put the children up to making the allegations. Her response was, "The reality is very few children who make sexual abuse allegations are false. It is very rare that a false allegation is made. The research will say 1 to 3%. I've seen a few kids over the year who have made false allegations. You can pick them out pretty quickly, though." This was on direct examination by the prosecutor. This was an improper opinion from Ms. Moore. Colorado has long held that it is improper for an expert or any witness to testify that a particular victim or witness's allegations in a specific instance are truthful. That is exactly what occurred in this instance. Her testimony is very similar to what occurred in Snook. Ms. Moore, like the expert in People versus Snook, was a so-called blind expert or educational expert. She had not interviewed the children. She had no knowledge of the case. She was there to basically educate the jury on some general information related to child sexual abuse that they may not be familiar with. The same was true in Snook. In Snook, the expert testified that children tend not to fabricate sexual abuse allegations, and our Supreme Court held that was improper opinion testimony, basically opining on the children's truthfulness in a specific instance, even though it was given in a very general form. Since Snook, the Colorado Supreme Court and divisions of this court have repeatedly held that this type of opinion testimony is improper. So I would assert that Ms. Moore's testimony was clearly improper under Snook. She went even further, though, and put statistics into the equation, saying that only 1 to 3% of these allegations are false. The converse of that is 97 to 99% are true. I think for most jurors, if you were to ask them to quantify beyond a reasonable doubt in a percentage term, 97 to 99% would qualify. They know they don't have to get to 100% because, as the prosecutor made clear during voir dire, it's not beyond all doubt, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So I think when you have an expert telling them that 97 to 99% of allegations are true, and that the kids who are making the false allegations are easy to spot. If you're a juror and you're sitting there and you've seen the kids testify and you don't think it's easy to spot, then once you have that expert's testimony, you're 97 to 99% sure they're telling the truth. And I think for many jurors, the trial could end right there because they could determine that's beyond a reasonable doubt.
So Mr. Middleton, there was no objection, no contemporaneous objection?
There was not, no.
Did defendant, though, turn this to his benefit? Didn't he make some arguments that indicated there could be lying going on in this particular circumstance?
When Ms. Moore testified, she expounded on the 1 to 3% on direct testimony and said that's usually when there's a messy divorce or relationship breakup. On cross-examination, defense counsel did pursue that and say the 1 to 3% that are making the false allegations are when the parents are splitting up or there's a messy divorce, that sort of thing. So he did try to fit himself in the 1 to 3%. I don't think that's turning it to his advantage. It's trying to ameliorate the harm from the admission of this testimony. And one of the cases that I cited in the brief was State v. Lindsay. And in that case, it was, I believe, Arizona Supreme Court, the testimony was that 99% of the expert, in the expert's opinion, 99% were telling the truth. And on cross-examination, similar to here, defense counsel tried to exploit that 1% and fit his client's situation into that 1%. And the court noted that that's what you expect defense counsel to do when evidence has been erroneously admitted, that they have to somehow ameliorate or undermine. So I think what defense counsel did here was what we'd expect to happen. I don't think it actually turned to his benefit because you're still talking only about 1% to 3%. Which gets me to the next opinion, because I think that actually compounds the harm and removes sort of that 1% to 3% aspect from Ms. Moore's testimony. Dr. Deborah Crawford testified that she examined TU in this case. TU was the younger child who had passed away. The examination occurred in 2009, fall of 2009, which was more than 5 years after Mr. Luke had left the home. Not surprisingly, she did not find any physical findings that would indicate sexual abuse. She did find a small anal fissure and some constipation, but she testified that based on that alone, there would be no finding of sexual abuse. Those things were very common and would not lead to a conclusion of sexual abuse. However, she testified that she took an extensive history from the mother in this case, and she actually related that history to the jury, wherein the mother told her the allegations against Mr. Luke, told her that Mr. Luke had been physically and sexually abusing TU. And so based upon that history, she testified to the jury that she concluded, my conclusion based on the history and the physical exam together was that TU had been physically, sexually, and emotionally abused. On cross-examination, she was asked whether she would have made that determination based on the physical exam, and she said no. So the history was critical, and the history was nothing more than the statements of the mother. So in essence, Dr. Crawford was ratifying the statements of the mother, and she testified not that it was consistent with abuse, she testified that TU had in fact been physically, sexually, and emotionally abused. She went beyond.
May I interrupt you for 1 second? Sorry. Wasn't her testimony, though, she explained that for purposes of making her diagnosis, she was relying upon the history and the physical findings, but clarified for the jury that she was not making a determination as to whether in fact abuse had occurred or whether the allegations were true?
I believe that's partially correct and partially incorrect. She stated that she was not assessing the truth of mother's allegations. When defense counsel was cross-examining her, defense counsel was trying to point out that there were things in mother's history that were incorrect. And she said that she basically would accept the mother's history as given and not question it. So to that extent, she was making clear that she was not really in an investigative capacity. But at the same time, when she was discussing that with defense counsel, she reiterated that it was her diagnosis that TU had been physically, sexually, emotionally abused. So on the one hand, she's saying, I'm not questioning the veracity of mother's history. But on the other hand, she's making that extra step. She's not just saying it's consistent. She's making the extra step and saying that she determined it did, in fact, occur. She did say that it was a medical diagnosis and not a legal diagnosis. But I think that's a distinction without much difference in this particular instance. And once you have Ms., or Dr. Crawford stating that by that point, when she's referring to TU, it's gone to essentially 100% that it occurred in her opinion. She's making that diagnosis. So I think that undermines the whole 1 to 3%, because if TU was 100% sexually assaulted, then the whole idea that the 1 to 3% arise out of false allegations related to a messy divorce situation has sort of been removed, because one of the children, according to Dr. Crawford, is telling the truth, which would necessarily also implicate the other child. Given the fact that there were no physical findings and credibility was the central issue in this case, these errors, I think, were very, very harmful and prejudicial to Mr. Luke and warrant reversal of the convictions. If there are no additional questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Ethan Zweig, registration number 44794, and I'm here today on behalf of the people. I plan on addressing the issues surrounding the expert testimony, but I will also be happy to answer any other questions this court might have. There was no plain error in allowing the prosecution's expert testimony. Ms. Moore's testimony was permissible for three reasons. First, it was directly analogous to the admissible testimony in People v. Cognac. Like testimony about battered women syndrome and delayed disclosure, it helped dispel a common misconception about abuse, and the testimony was directly beneficial to the defendant in this case. It was directly analogous to the testimony in People v. Cognac because it aided the jury in understanding a characteristic of sexual abuse that it could not have been presumed to have knowledge of, particularly that false allegations regularly occur. Similarly, like battered women syndrome, like testimony about battered women syndrome and delayed disclosure, it ensured that the jury did not operate under a misconception about abuse, again, that false allegations occur regularly. Finally, as the testimony
Mr. Zweig, doesn't this take it to the opposite extreme, though? If you say it dispels the misconception that abuse is falsified, it takes it from it rebuts falsification, but then it goes to the other extreme and says it's almost always true. So it's more than rebuttal, it's substantive kind of evidence that says here in this case, defendant is, you know, he's not within that 1 to 3%.
I think that, 2 points really. I think that this information, generally we don't want the jury basing its verdict on a misconception that they might, based on knowledge that they would not have otherwise have, or that they would commonly have. Commonly, you know, if you might think that, you know, kids lie about important things, kids make false, you know, statements to parents or to the police, and you don't want the jury operating under such a misconception. With the specific facts of this case, the inference from the testimony, there was no testimony about the specifics of this case from Ms. Moore, but if any inference can be drawn is that the allegations were less credible because it fell directly into the rare circumstances in which false allegations occur. This was a messy divorce. The defense was based on a theory that the children were lying to the police because their mother had told them to in order to keep, where the allegation was that to keep the defendant away from the children. And in this case, so in this case, he fell directly into the 1 to 3%. So if any inference can be made about the specifics of this case, it was that the allegations were less credible.
May I ask you a question about, do you see a distinction between the witness testifying that it's not common to find physical evidence in support of allegations and then testimony that 1 to 3% of the allegations that children make regarding sexual abuse are false? Do you see a distinction between the character of those two statements?
I don't necessarily see a distinction. I think in cases where there's a sort of a defense theory that there, you know, there weren't any physical findings here of abuse, so there wasn't any abuse. I think that testimony is helpful to the jury and information that they would not have had otherwise, or would not have known otherwise. I think commonly you think if there's sexual abuse, there are physical findings. And I think sort of percentage testimonies about not finding physical findings rebuts a defense similar to the 1 to 3% testimony. With respect to Dr. Crawford's testimony, an expert can testify that a victim displayed characteristics similar to that of a typical victim of abuse. Dr. Crawford's testimony was not simply a ratification of the medical history given to her by TU's mother. She made it very clear that if TU's mother had lied to her, her opinion would have been different. So it was clear to the jury that Dr. Crawford's testimony was based on information that she had relied on, and that is a limitation that all doctors work within when coming to a medical opinion. They rely on the medical history given to them, and they don't go investigate that, and she made it very clear that that was the case in this case. In addition, the evidence was not unfairly prejudicial in this case. First, Luke never objected to the evidence, and Dr. Crawford made it clear on cross-examination that her opinion was a medical opinion and not a legal conclusion. In addition, the jury was also given the expert testimony instruction and told that it was not bound by her testimony, and the jury is presumed to have followed those instructions. So in this case, Dr. Crawford gave permissible expert testimony, and that testimony was not unfairly prejudicial.
Mr. Zweig, why is there a distinction in this particular case between an opinion that is a medical opinion and a legal opinion? Because the issue is, did the abuse occur? And she has testified some abuse occurred. She didn't say defendant committed it, but she said some abuse occurred.
I think her testimony was based on the information that I received. My opinion would be that some abuse occurred. I think two things are important there. The first is, she made it very clear that that opinion was based on the information she got. And on cross-examination, she was repeatedly questioned about if this had been different, would your opinion have been the same? And she said, my opinion would have been different. Also, she did not testify that this defendant committed the abuse. Her opinion was that some abuse, based on the information that I have, I believe some abuse occurred. And I think that's the distinction between a medical opinion in this case and making a legal conclusion as to the charges against this defendant. If there are no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the court below. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
A few things briefly. First of all, I think that this case goes far beyond what occurred in Cognac, at least from the details in this court's opinion. It does involve the same two witnesses, but Ms. Moore did not opine, at least in the opinion, regarding any statistics or regarding false allegations. Dr. Crawford did not give a diagnosis. She did say 90 to 95% have no physical findings. She said that in this case, too. And I haven't complained of that part of her testimony. The reality is this was, as I said, 5 years after the alleged abuse, so one wouldn't be expecting necessarily to find physical findings, which is why it's all the more problematic when she makes the diagnosis of sexual abuse. And Judge Casebolt, I do think that her testimony taken in context does opine that it was Mr. Luke who committed it, because she said based on the history and the physical findings the abuse occurred, the only history given to her was that Mr. Luke committed this abuse. So I do think as a practical matter, it was an opinion, not only that the abuse occurred, but that it occurred in the way that it was provided to her in the history. One of the things I did want to point out that was brought up in the people's brief was regarding 608. They argued that because there was an attack on the credibility of the children that this opinion was authorized. First of all, I'd say that there was not a general attack on their character for truthfulness under the case law, which finds that an attack on credibility and aggressive cross-examination is not an attack on general character for truthfulness. Second, under Snook and Gaffney and those line of cases, they also point out that even if it would be permissible to opine on general character for truthfulness, this type of testimony is opining on their truthfulness in a specific instance regarding the allegations that they've made, and that is not permissible under 608. And then with respect to Ms. Moore, she was a blind expert, had no contact with the children at all, and would not have been in a position under 608 to opine on their credibility with any sort of foundation or their reputation for trustworthiness. So 608 would not be a vehicle to allow these opinions either. I just wanted to sort of end with the Supreme Court's Gaffney decision, where they're quoting the Arizona Supreme Court. They say, when the only evidence consists of the victim's accusation and the defendant's denial, expert testimony on the question of who to believe is nothing more than advice to jurors on how to decide the case. Such testimony was not legitimized by Rule 704 and is not admissible under Rule 702. The same principle applies to expert opinion testimony on whether the crime occurred, whether the defendant is the perpetrator, and like questions. The testimony of Ms. Moore and Dr. Crawford fell squarely within those improper opinions and amounted to plain error in this case, and we would request that this court reverse Mr. Luke's convictions. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.